I want to let you all know, first and foremost, I am grateful for being here this morning. And out of respect, I must say that my gratitude runs very deep. You see, before there was a Hackensack, before there was a New Jersey, before there was a United States of America, there was a black church. This institution has seen the larger community. Now, I'm not just talking about black folks. It has been a driving force in the manifestation of the ideals of America and has helped to drive this country through the depths of and degradation of slavery, through the moral offense of Jim Crow, through the challenges and atrocities of child labor, through poverty and pain, through subjugation. This institution has helped this nation rise off of its knees of hopes and stand tall as a beacon of freedom and hope to the globe. I stand here in reverence to the black church, for I am a product of the black church. I grew up in a very small church. You drive by, you wouldn't even know it's there. Centennial AME in Colster, New Jersey was where I grew up. And I was one of those kids that your mama dragged her to church. I tried to find every excuse not to go. But you know what it says in the Bible. If you raise a child up in the way that he shall go, not going to depart from it. So I want you to know, not only do I give reverence for what is a institution, but we know in the black church, the history is not about coming here and preaching on Sunday, but on practicing Monday through Saturday. The history of the black church is not just out here and shouting and yelling about what is right and then going out and walking left. It is about showing that you are a Christian through your love, through your love, through your love. And so my gratitude also stems to a certain pastor. Certain pastor with the first name Gregory. Who is a man that I have met in passing numerous times. He reminded me that he heard me speak out in Colorado when we were getting our president nominated. But there is an old saying that says, and you know it from the hymnal, "Let the work I've done speak for me." You see, I've learned to not judge a man by what he says, but by what he does. And your pastor has given honor to a church that has a 122-year tradition in our community. And he told me he's been a pastor here since he was 27 years. And it is because of his invitation, really, that I am here today. And I am grateful to share some of my thoughts with you, especially as it relates to our common history. But let me start with a story, if I can. And I have a Bible here, and please forgive me, it's a slightly apocryphal story, but there is a church in Newark where a pastor was having a very difficult time. Two young boys were cutting up something awful. And everybody tried to intervene with these two young men, and the elders in the church tried to take the boys on aside and speak some sense into them. The deacons and deaconesses tried to stop them from going that wrong path, but these young boys just would not have it so. As my mama said, they had a hard head. And so what finally the pastor had to intervene, and he decided to bring the two brothers back to his office, but he sat the younger one outside to have a good conversation with the older of the boys, and he sat the boy down in front of his desk, and he sat behind the desk, and he said, looked at him hard, and the boy was staring at him with his nostrils flaring, and the pastor was staring at him back, and the pastor said, "I'm going to try a different approach," he thought to himself. So he put his hand on the Bible in front of his desk and said, "My son, I need you to tell me something. Where is God?" And the boy opened his eyes and looked inquisitive. And the pastor said, "Okay, I got his attention." So the pastor said with a deeper, more baritone voice, and this time he lifted his Bible up and he said, "My son, I need you to tell me, where is God?" And now the boy sat back in his chair and it looked like he was even starting to shake a little bit. The pastor was getting carried away. He knew he had this boy. Somehow he got his attention. So now he leans over his desk, shaking his Bible at the boy and says, "Boy, tell me right now, where is God?" And at that point, the boy jumped up, shaken from head to toe, sprinted out of the pastor's office, grabbed his younger brother by the hand and said, "We got to get out of here. God's missing." And the pastor thinks we took him. Genesis chapter 3, verse 9. Ask the question. It made a lot of sense to me as a boy when I was at Centennial AME just up the road here. I didn't understand it. How could this verse have God, the omniscient being, the all-knowing, all-seeing being, walk into the Garden of Eden and ask the question, Adam, where are you? Adam was just hiding up behind the bushes. I played hide-and-go-seek when I was a kid. I could have found Adam. I did not understand why they were hiding and God could not find them. And so as a little boy, I had to ask that to my mama. And my mother didn't give me a satisfactory answer. So I asked it to the pastor. And this is the response I got. You see, God was not asking where the physical Adam was. He wanted to know, where is this man that I created in my image? I breathed the breath of life into his body. He was imbued with the very spirit of the divine. Where is he? Why is he shrinking from the truth of who he truly is? Why has he forgotten his origins? Why is he hiding from me? Carter G. Woodson, who was the originator of Negro History Week, that now we know as Black History Month, said in a profound contribution to the literary works of America, a book called The Miseducation of the Negro, he said very simply that the primary cause of human suffering is forgetfulness. And so here we are in Black History again, a month, 28 days, where we turn on the TV and we watch different tributes to African American leaders, and I'm not comfortable with that. First of all, I think there's something going wrong when we take these days of profound purpose and meaning that should be transformative to our souls, and we reduce things like Easter down to fuzzy bunnies and chocolate eggs. We as Christians know that's not what Easter is about. It is about the resurrection. And now when we get into Black History Month, I worry that we have a Santa Clausification of the figures from our history. And we gloss them over with simplistic tropes that do not satisfy the current need for justice within our community. King wasn't somebody that we roll out and was nice and comfortable and you could cozy up with him. He was a brother that challenged us, who had enemies in the white supremacist community and in the Black church, who took stances that were not popular, that were not just about civil rights, but human rights. And so what even makes me feel a little more uncomfortable is that we see Black history as this great man view of history, where these heroes came down larger than life and led us to freedom. That is not the case. We are here today not because of a small group of greater than life people. We are here today because of humble heroes who every single day found ways to be a part of a larger struggle. We don't know their names, but in the bowels of boats in the Middle Passage, chained to dead bodies, they had the will to live. They would not be blotted from this earth. They may not be free, but their children or their grandchildren would inherit the spirit of freedom. You may chain my body, but you cannot possess my soul. We are here today because somebody didn't give up. Because somebody refused to give in. And so, generation after generation, ordinary people whose names we do not know, that had no special DNA, that were given no miraculous powers, found a way to persist against incredible odds. You know, my daddy and my mama, they're great people, and I owe everything I am to my God first and to the parents they gave me, to God that God gave me. And I'll tell you this, they were so aggressive in not letting my brother and I forget. They knew how pernicious forgetfulness can be, and they knew that the powerful streams of media would try to erode my understanding and my conception of who I am. Now, my father had a way about him. He would tell a lot of the stories over and over again as I grew up. And now that I'm 41 years old, I can challenge him a little bit because the stories change a little bit, Dad, as you get a little older. First, he was poor. You know, he was born a poor black child. And now he says, Corey, well, I wasn't a poor black child. I was just Poe. I couldn't afford the other two letters. I was a Poe boy born to a single mother in North Carolina. And he, you know, these stories, it was North Carolina. Dad, in the beginning, the stories sounded believable, but how could there have been a hurricane and a tsunami in every story now? And it's North Carolina. It was snowing all the time. And my father, first, you know, I've been there. I've seen some of these places. And now he tries to tell me that he didn't grow up in a one-room schoolhouse anymore. Now it's just a lean-to on the side of a mountain. And my father tells a story. He was sitting in the back of the room, and the woman comes there and says, "Now, class, anybody here, I'm teaching y'all about self-esteem. And anybody in this classroom thinks you're stupid, stand up." And my father said he sat in the classroom with everybody. Look at this woman, stand up for them. And my father tells a story. He says the woman kept repeating herself, "Come on, now, I need you to teach you to believe it in yourself. It's about self-esteem. If you think you're stupid, you think you're dumb, stand up." And she stood there waiting. My father says he just pushed his chair back and stood up. And the teacher says to him, "Mr. Booker, boy, what's wrong with you? You think you're dumb? You think you're stupid?" And my father shook his head and said, "Well, shucks, ma'am, I don't think I'm stupid, but I didn't want you to be the only one standing." Now, this is my parents now. They said, "Corey, and my brother Carrie, you need to stand up for who you are and not forget where you've come from." To this day, they told me that this institution saved my life. My father couldn't pay his tuition when he finally got a chance to go to North Carolina Central University. He knew he had to go down there and try to get a job, but that would take a while for his paycheck to come in. So it was strangers who I will never know that put dollar bills in envelopes and handed it to my dad so he could pay his first semester's tuition. That's my history. That's black history. My parents got into the sit-in movement. I sat with some of these folks listening to their stories with tears in my eyes when the first sit-in movement started at Woolworths in 1961 in Greensboro, North Carolina. The students' names we have forgotten. There were hundreds and hundreds of them. I met some of them telling stories about being threatened by the black college that you will be expelled if you continue this agitation. My parents moved to from North Carolina and met in Washington, D.C. White companies wouldn't hire black people. But it was the Urban League, my parents would tell me, that went out to break open these companies to hire blacks for the first time. I don't know the name of one person involved in the Urban League in Washington, D.C., but they did a phenomenal job. My father was the first black salesman at Sinclair Oil Company, the first black buyer at a department store called Woodruff and Latham, and then he and my mom became two of the first blacks hired by IBM. This is our history. People doing for people. And then my parents moved up here to New Jersey. Let me tell you, 1969-70, and some of you all know this, they wouldn't show black families homes in white neighborhoods. They wouldn't do it. But my mom and dad bumped into some folks at the Fair Housing Council, good folks, black and white, that said, "Let's bust this up a little bit. Would you be willing to be a test couple?" And my mom and my daddy knew where they came from, and they said, "To fight against injustice, we will. We're new in this state, but we'll do it." They showed up in Bergen County, to towns all around this county. They'd show up, they told the house is sold, or the sellers changed their mind, and the white couple would show up right after them. Ironically, Mr. and Mrs. Brown, but they were not brown. And the Browns would be told the house was for sale. My parents settled on a house in Harrington Park, New Jersey, and they loved the house, but they were told it was sold. So the white couple came behind them and made a bid on the house, and the day of the closing, instead of the white couple, the Browns showing up, my father showed up with a young lawyer. I don't know his name. Confronted the real estate agent and said, "You are in violation of New Jersey fair housing." Well, the real estate agent got up and punched the lawyer, signaled dog on my dad. A melee broke out. At the end, he fell on his knees begging my family not to move into the town because we would ruin the town. My parents, of course, sued. And we grew up, as my father used to say, four raisins in a tub of vanilla ice cream here in Bergen County. Now, my parents told me every day, never forget where you came from. People stood for you. They fought for you. They bled the soil of this country red for you. That is your history. And history comes with obligations. We drink deeply from wells of freedom and liberty that we did not dig. We eat lavishly from banquet tables prepared for us by our ancestors, and we have a choice. Will we get drunk on the wine of their sacrifice and struggle? Will we grow fat on the harvest of heroes before us? Or will we metabolize our privilege and opportunity and use it to go forward?
Yes, sir.
Now, I have to tell you, I'm worried. A little further in the Bible, a powerful prescription for truth is Moses on the verge of the promised land, and he sends 12 people into the promised land to see what's going on. 10 of them come back, and they say, "We can't go there. There's giants there." I love this passage so much, I went to some of my rabbi friends. I wanted to hear it in Hebrew. And the Hebrew in the Torah, it says, they saw us as grasshoppers in their eyes. But this is it. We saw ourselves as grasshoppers in their eyes. You all know the story because 10 came back, had that story, but two of them didn't. Who were they? Joshua and Caleb. There's some people that pay attention to you, Pastor. They had a different story. You see, they knew their history. How quickly did they forget that it was God who brought them out of Egypt? It was God who split the Red Sea. It was God who made the manna fall from heaven. How dare we forget as a people? In 1999, I thought I was something special. I got called to Essex County College to give a speech on peace. And I was troubled by the violence in Newark. And I roll up to Essex County College and there's a line outside. And I'm like, all these folks hear me. God has a way when you get a little big for your britches to take you down to size, doesn't he? I walk in there and I'm all high on myself. And I had written a speech about peace and nonviolence and looked through lots of, from Mandela to King. I was ready to go. And then I walk in and look up and there's this big poster there. Concert tonight. Ja Rule. And I'm like, all these black folks lining up. Not for me. And at that point, I hear a packed gymnasium, people banging their feet and yelling out, "Ja Rule, Ja Rule." And the man says, "Mr. Booker, we're so happy to hear you. We want you to give the positive message before the Ja Rule concert." And all I'm hearing is a chance for Ja Rule. And I said, "He may be Ja Rule, but I'm no fool." This brother knows this ain't cool. And my best attempts to convince them that that was not a wise thing, I had an aide there, a young man graduated from Hampton University, saying, "Mayor, you got to, councilman at that time, you got to do this. Corey, you got to do this." And now I know that they're not only are they speaking to me, but they're sort of backing me towards the stage entrance. And I decide that I'm either going to have to fight my way forward, which would look really bad for a man that wanted to give a speech on nonviolence, or I could turn around and go on that stage. So I turn around and walk on the stage. And now the crowd erupts in cheers. But now I know they're not cheering me. They're cheering because they think I am there to introduce Ja Rule. And so when you are in the pit, you got to pray, right? Well, I grabbed that microphone, and God gave me a little divine spark. And I said, "Y'all ready for Ja Rule?" And everybody went, "Yeah!" I said, "Are you ready for Ja Rule?" And everybody went crazy. And now I thought, okay, I got him now. I said, "Is there anybody here black?" And I tell you, a room packed full of black folks, we got some pride. Everybody started saying, "Yes." And I said, "Are there real black people here?" And everybody's like, "Yes." And I said, "Black people, make some noise." And everybody made some noise. And then I said, "Well, if y'all really black, then tell me something." And everybody got quiet. And I said, "Why is it that 5 generations ago, they were literally locking our people in bondage? And now, we only make up 12% of New Jersey's population, but over 60% of the prison population." And everybody suddenly got quiet. I heard somebody say, "Say what?" And then I said, "And now tell me something. Why was it 2 generations ago, white supremacists were picking up guns and lynching and shooting black people? James Meredith, Medgar Evers, Martin Luther King. Yes. And now a black man in America is 100 times more likely to be shot by somebody black than by anybody white." I said, now tell me something. Why was it just 2 generations ago in America, and evil scientists were literally injecting African Americans with diseases? You all remember the Tuskegee syphilis experiment? But now here we are, spreading deadly diseases to each other through practices in the bedroom or whatever room y'all could find. So now tell me something, I said. Why is it that black women, 4 or 5 generations ago, being raped by white men who thought they were their masters, and now 1 out of every 5 black women in America will be struck, beaten, hit, abused by a black man? Everybody was quiet, and I said, "Y'all got to remember what it means to be black. It's not the music you listen to. It's not the food that you eat. It is the spirit of struggle, answering the call for justice." And so this is what worries me today. Because how can we celebrate black history and not demonstrate our commitment to making history today? I see in my city my elders who get it. They haven't forgotten in the way that my generation has, or those coming up behind me. Pastor talked about government workers, and there seems to be an assault on people that work for government. Man in my city on Elizabeth Avenue retired from being a state worker, collecting his pension. He got a stimulus check in the mail like many of us. Now, he didn't go out like many of my friends did and pay off their credit card bills, go out and get an Xbox or a Wii. This brother saw that check as an opportunity. He went over to Home Depot on Springfield Avenue and he brought himself a lawnmower and a weed whacker. You see, because outside of the building he lived on Elizabeth Avenue, there was an overgrown lot, weeds and trash and debris, that was being used for drug dealing. And this brother, retired man, probably every right just to rest, took his lawnmower and his weed whacker out into that lot and started mowing the lawn. Now, people were afraid for him on the first day because he bagged up everything that was there, and some people thought he might have bagged up the stash of the drug dealers. But he kept going out to that lot, and he turned a eyesore, a nuisance, into a beautiful lawn, took care of it, and became a hero in his community because the drug dealers, they left. We found him because he was mowing the lawn along the median of Elizabeth Avenue, and we stopped him and said, "Who are you?" And he said, "I am here. When Abraham was called by God to sacrifice Isaac, he didn't hide behind the bushes. He didn't do what Moses said, and don't take me, take my brother. He stood up and said, 'Behold, Lord, here I am.'" This is the calling that echoes through our history. This is the shame that we will have to repent for if we do not answer that call. King said it clearly. We will have to repent in this day and age, not for the violent actions and vitriolic words of the bad people, but the appalling silence and inaction of the good people. This is what we will have to repent for. Not because the problems are so bad. We've seen bad problems before. But because we fail to do something about them. And don't start making excuses. We have gotten into this state of sedentary agitation where we could sit in our homes on our couches and get angry as heck. And we are really good at descriptive analyses of the problem. We can talk about what's going on in our world with precise precision. But it's not about sedentary agitation, nor is it about a toxic resignation. People in this nation have surrendered that there'll always be poverty, surrendered that there'll always be schools that don't work, have surrendered to what is, and have given up on fighting for what can be. And the problem is, we have to have a parallel track here. One is beginning to wake us up to who we are. Harriet Tubman, she's my icon. Really only one thing besides the holy books that sit on my desk is Harriet Tubman. She said, "I freed 1,000 slaves, but I could have freed 1,000 more if they only knew they were slaves." We as individuals have become enslaved to materialism, to consumerism, to narcissism, to me-ism. I'm telling you right now, if we recognize the truth of who we are, our world changes around us. When I first showed up at Newark, I was an arrogant second-year law student. I knocked on the door of the tenant president of these high-rises called Brick Towers, and she opened the door. And she said, "Who are you?" And in my best John Wayne imitation, I said, "Well, I'm Cory Booker, ma'am. I'm here to help you." And she looks at me. Miss Virginia Jones, we buried her last month, looks at me and says, "Say what? You want to help me?" I said, "Yes, ma'am. I'm here to help. I'm a Yale law student. I live across the street now." And she says, "You need to follow me." And she closes the door. She walks me down 5 flights of stairs. She walks me into the middle of Martin Luther King Boulevard. And I should have listened to my grandparents. You see, every graduation, they said something to me. They said, "Boy, never forget the degree you hold was paid for by the blood, sweat, and tears of the ancestors." They said to me, "Boy, you see that tassel? It was worth the hassle, wasn't it?" And then they would always tell me, "Never forget you could learn more from a woman on the 5th floor of the projects than you ever can from one of these fancy professors." And so here was this woman from the 5th floor staring at me in the middle of Martin Luther King Boulevard in Newark. And she says, "Tell me what you see around you." And I said, "What do you mean?" And she says, "Describe what you see." So I described. I said, "I see an abandoned building that was used for drugs. I described the graffiti, the project. I just described it." And she shook her head and she said, boy, you can never help me. And I said, what do you mean? She walks away. And I chased after her. I said, I don't understand. I'm confused. I don't understand. And she says, you need to understand something, boy. That the world you see outside of you is a reflection of what you have inside of you. If every time you open your eyes, you see problems and darkness and despair, that kind of negativity, that's all there's ever going to be. But if you're one of those people, whoever you open your eyes, you see hope and opportunity and possibility. And you see love and the face of God, then you can be someone who helps me. Get back. I stood there thinking to myself, scratching my head, thinking, okay, grasshopper, thus ended the lesson. But I came correct. You see, so many of us don't understand that before we can change the world, we have to change ourselves. We have to come right with God. I look back to my Bible. It says it right there. I can do all things through Christ who strengthened me. But that's not just words to read. Are we manifesting that in our world? People let ourselves get discouraged. The measure of a great person is their ability to continue despite discouragement. Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I fear no evil. It is about us. We have these parents that don't realize every one of your habits, good and bad, is going to be passed to your kids. Our history tells us that. James Baldwin wrote it clearly. Children are never good at listening to their elders, but they never fail to imitate them. And so we as a people have to make a choice every day. That is it honoring our history or ignoring it? And the choice is simple. We can accept conditions as they are or take responsibility for changing them. We cannot wait on the world. Miss Virginia Jones, this great hero of mine, I had to interview her after my first mayoral election for Esquire magazine. Again, I went to her thinking I was special. I was writing for Esquire. And I started interviewing her about her life. And I never knew that her son went overseas and fought for the American military. Came back over here, and in the lobby of the building, she was dragged to that lobby one day. Her son was visiting her. She gets into the lobby by a weeping woman, dragged there, and she could not speak to her as she was dragging her down. Miss Jones couldn't understand what was going on. She gets into that lobby, and she sees her son with bullet holes in his chest, bleeding that pavement red. I've seen enough of this. I felt like giving up at times. I've sat with a gunshot victim trying to stop blood coming from his chest, screaming for the ambulance to come. I'll never forget a boy that I watched grow up in Brick Towers where I was living for 8 years. And he was murdered on Court Street in Newark, and I went to his funeral, and everybody was there. It was a packed funeral. Teachers and community leaders, all there to condemn what was. I went back to the mayor's office after that funeral, and for the first time, I was in office for 2 months at that point, I sat in my office and I wept. Where was all those people at his funeral? Where were they for his life? So my interview with Miss Jones, she had a different perspective. She tells me the story of her son slain on the floor, how she fell to her knees, screaming out in agony. She finishes the story, and I look at her. That was back in the 80s. I said, Miss Jones, I know where you work. She and I paid market rent to live in these high-rise projects. I know the money you make, ma'am. I said, you could live anywhere. Why do you still live here? In the building, have to walk through the lobby every day where your son was murdered. Why do you stay here? And she looks at me hard in the face. And she says, boy, why do I still live here? I said, yes. She goes, why do I live in apartment 5A still? I said, yes. She goes, why am I still the tenant president of these buildings since 1969 when they were built? that's electoral longevity for you? I said, yes. And she crosses her arms, sticks out her chest, and she says, because I'm in charge of Homeland Security. Now, wait a minute. Fred Shuttleworth, his home was bombed. His wife was chain whipped. He was stabbed. But he took responsibility for breaking Jim Crow. There were activists who got on buses from New Jersey to do freedom rides, who had the buses bombed and they were beaten, but they still went on to register more voters. There's Harriet Tubman, who herself escaped slavery and didn't stop, but she kept going down 19 times. She was taking responsibility for the entire institution of slavery and its demise. We can sit back here now and say, what's going on with the world? But the question about Black history is, what are we doing? And don't tell me what can't be done. At the end of the fire next time, a great book by Baldwin, he writes, and I paraphrase, I know what I'm asking you is impossible, but in today's day and age, the impossible is the least we can demand. And what is, after all, emboldened by the spectacle of human history in general and Negro history in particular, because it is all a testimony to the achievement of the impossible. And we, and by we, I mean the truly conscious blacks and the truly conscious whites who must, like lovers, come together and create the consciousness of us all, we must now dare to end the nightmare. And if we fail to do that, we are destined to recreate the Bible prophecy made real in the Negro spiritual, no more water, the fire next time. And so I come to an end of my remarks with a few points. The first one is, let us celebrate our history. Let us tell the truth of it. We may have forgotten the names of the many, but grab somebody by the hand who remembers what it was like to go to a water fountain that said colors only. Grab somebody by hand and remember when you couldn't go to certain places in this county, you weren't welcome. Understand that where we are right now, the ability to spend our dollars wherever we want to, the ability to go to any community, came as a price. But also remember that we are not free yet. That children coast to coast, as a chorus to our consciousness, say these five words: liberty and justice for all. Every morning, asking us to make real on these aspirational statements. Think about these things. And then decide whether you are going to swear an oath. An oath that has nothing to do with words, but with your actions. How will you live to combat the problems of today? How will you live to combat the disparities in healthcare outcomes, the number one killer of black women being heart disease? How will you live to combat too many children going astray? Will you recognize that right now in New Jersey, hundreds and hundreds of kids on waiting lists for a mentor, a big brother, or a big sister. It takes 4 hours a month, the amount of time we spend watching our favorite TV program. Ask yourself, how am I living to prove worthy of the legacy of the black church? Am I making my tithe or my offer? Am I getting involved? Am I bringing my children? Am I inviting friends of mine who need some prayer? Ask yourself, how am I living in my neighborhood? What am I willing to walk past and ignore and pretend it's not there? And then see if you'll swear the oath of one of our great leaders, a poet of America named Langston Hughes, who said very simply, "Oh, let America be America again. the land that never has been yet, but yet must be, the land where everyone is free. The poor man, the Indian, the Negro, me. Who made America? Whose sweat and blood? Whose faith and pain? Whose hand at the foundry? Whose plow in the rain must make our mighty dream live again? Oh, yes, I say it plain. America never was America to me. But I swear this oath, America will be. There can be no progress without struggle. Change will not roll in on the wheels of inevitability. Faith is nothing without works. It is dead. We are the generation that is called to finish the work of Moses. We are the generation that's called to stand on the high mountain and not just see the promised land, but get there. We are the generation that's called not just to weep in the nighttime, but let the joy cometh in the morning. Thank you.